could interrupt just for 1 minute, could we get cell phones turned off, please?
Andy is requesting that you turn your cell phones off.
Yes!
Now, if you're alcoholic like I'm alcoholic, I don't like being told what to do. So if you got a cell phone with you this afternoon, turn it on. But if you could put it on, particularly if you're getting a liver transplant, all right? But if you could put it on vibrate, that way you could enjoy your incoming call and you wouldn't disturb the rest of us. My name is Jack and I'm an alcoholic. And I come to you from Hagerstown, Maryland, where I am a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our group is the third oldest group in the state of Maryland, and when it was begun, you had one town, you had one group. I mean, that's the way they did it. But a few resentments and a couple coffee pots later, we now have 15 groups and 50-some meetings a week. So that's how we grow in AA, and that's how we're growing in Hagerstown. I want to thank Andy for introducing me, such as it was. Andy and Tim came and picked me up at the airport last night when I got in, and they said, is there anything we can do for you? I said, I am really hungry, because, you know, they don't serve anything on planes. I've been on a plane for 6 hours. He said, well, where do you like to go? I said, you know, Olive Garden or Macaroni Grill or even Sherry's would be good. That'd be great. So he took me to Burgerville, and then after I had placed my order, the young lady behind the counter asked me if I wanted the senior discount. Can you imagine that? I didn't even ask for it. And then she gave it to Tim also, which he doesn't deserve it, but he took it anyway. So I want to thank the committee for allowing Harlan to invite me to come here to be with y'all. I think it's really important that you know who's responsible for my being here. Because if I say anything that offends you during the next 3.5 hours that we're together, I want you to take that up with Harlan, because he's the one who's responsible for my being here. Now, I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I can really see it or pay much attention to it, but I just think it gives hope to the newcomer. So My mother is going to be 94 years old next month. And the reason I mention that is because she was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years. And I called her before coming over here this afternoon just to touch base and let her know where I was. And she said, are you talking to another one of those AA things? And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. And she says, you make sure you tell those people that you are not an alcoholic. And, my mom knows what an alcoholic is. I mean, she was married to my alcoholic dad for 30 years, so she ought to know. And it causes me a good deal of concern, to be quite honest with you, because I really would like to start listening to my mom. About time, I think. And I mean, it's quite possible that I've overreacted to this whole thing. And so we're going to we'll take a trip down memory lane, such as it is, and see if maybe we can pick out some benchmarks along the way that may indicate whether I belong here or not. I began to drink when I was about 14 years of age, and I think alcohol did for me what it did for you. Once I got enough on board to change my perception of the reality of my life, it allowed me to do things drinking that I couldn't do not drinking. And for me, indeed, it did seem to be the elixir of life. And I was sorry that, I knew why my dad drank. It was too bad he couldn't hold his booze like I could, but I certainly understood why he drank. And I used to say that drinking really didn't cause me any difficulty when I... when I was in high school, but now as a result of good sponsorship, I have to tell you that I spent 5 years in high school. And I thought it was a result of a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but turned out it was the booze. But when I got out of high school, I went to the community college, and one summer, my good friend Bill and I had decided that we were going to take a road trip. We were going to go to California, and we got 12 cases of beer, and we put them in the back of my car, and each packed an overnight bag, and we had everything you need to go from Maryland to California. I'd quit my job. I had had some money, and the night before we were to leave, Bill's dad wouldn't let him go. And I was crushed. Bill was a stand-up guy, and he gave me his half interest in the 12 cases of beer. And as some of you know, the easternmost border of the state of Maryland is on the Atlantic Ocean, and we have a resort community there called Ocean City. And so with those 12 cases of beer in my pocket full of money, I went down to Ocean City, where I spent the month of August living as a bum. I didn't have a job, but you know, I had those 12 cases of beer, and I had money to buy more beer when that ran out, and I had a great month in Ocean City, and I enjoyed myself so much that I decided that I wanted to work in Ocean City the next summer. And so I am a keen observer of my surroundings, and it was apparent to me, if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted over the course of a summer, it didn't make any difference if you were a lifeguard or a beach boy or a waiter or a waitress, a bartender or a bellhop. If you drank like I drank and acted like I acted over the course of a summer, there was a real good chance you were going to get arrested. And I did not want to get arrested. But I did see that there was a group of people working in Ocean City that drank like I drank and acted like I acted, and they were not getting arrested. And these were the members of the Ocean City Police Department. So I became a police officer. Now, the first year I was a police officer, they gave me a boardwalk beat. And within 7 or 10 days, it became apparent that I possess a talent that's very handy when you're walking a boardwalk beat in a resort community, and that is I can spot an underage drinker from about 100 yards away. And I would pick out my target of opportunity. I would approach them, establish that indeed they were underage, bless you. I would ask what was in the cooler. They would tell me, well, I got some Coca-Cola in there and little thing of Tupperware with some tuna fish and a half a loaf of bread. And I said, could we lift the lid? And sure, we can look in there. And there would be the nice even row of Coca-Cola and the crushed ice and the little Tupperware of tuna fish. Are you allergic to me? And bless you. And there was then the little thing of bread. But I would reach down into the bottom of that cooler, and invariably I'd come up with a Budweiser. Now, if you were that underage drinker, your life, as you have known it, has just ended because you're going to jail. Oh, yeah, I understand that you thought you were going to go to college, but you're not going to college. You're going to jail. And no self-respecting college is going to accept you into their school once they find out that you've been in the Ocean City Jail. Maybe you were thinking about a military career. Well, that's not happening. The United States military does not need guys like you who've been in the Ocean City Jail. As a matter of fact, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm calling your mom and dad back in Baltimore, and I'm telling them that you are in the Ocean City Jail, and they have to come down and bail you out. What's that? You'd like to offer a compromise? An alternative. What did you have in mind? Confiscate the beer. Well, that's certainly worthy of consideration, but you do understand that if I confiscate the beer, I'm going to have to take the cooler. And if I take the cooler, I'm going to have to take the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. You're okay with that. All right. But you're going to have to promise me that you are never, ever going to do any anything like this again in Ocean City. You promise? Okay, you're free to go. Now, it's really hard to walk a boardwalk beat dragging a cooler full of beer around behind you. And so I had to work out an arrangement with my lieutenant and my sergeant, and they'd come with their squad car, and they would pick up the coolers as I accumulated them. And then at the end of the shift, if I had gotten any wine or whiskey, I'd give that to them, and I would take the coolers and the beer and the tuna fish. And I had a great summer that summer. I drank every day. I had never bought anything to drink the entire summer, and I didn't get arrested. And that's my idea of a good summer. So I went back for a second summer, and the second summer they gave me a squad car. Yeah, lights and sirens, you betcha. It's one of those big old Ford Crown Victorias. I mean, you ever look in the trunks of one of those things? You can get three bodies or five coolers in there. And it was, I really didn't need my lieutenant and sergeant as much as I did the previous summer, but they maintained a keen interest in my activities, and I would meet them at the end of every shift, and I would give them the whiskey and the wine, and I kept the coolers and the beer. And if you were a friend of mine, or you really didn't have to be a friend of mine, you could be a friend of a friend of mine, and you came to Ocean City and you needed a cooler, I'm your guy. I mean, I got coolers stacked up to the ceiling of my back porch, and I have a no-return policy. Take anyone you want and have a good weekend here in Ocean City. Just don't get arrested. I had a great summer that summer. I drank every day. Didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer. And I didn't get arrested. So I'm on a roll now. So I went back for a third summer. They gave me my squad car back that third summer. Now, at this, I mean, I'm a college kid at this time, and I don't have any direction really in my life. I've got no idea what I want to do as a career or life's work or work, period. I mean, you know, it fascinated me. I could watch it for days on end, but I didn't like doing it. And so I was kind of at a loss, but so here I am. I'm working in Ocean City, and I'm going to tell you about an event that changed the course of my life. Stopped this guy on the beach highway at 3 o'clock in the morning. He was obviously drunk, got him out of the car, was writing him up for drunk driving, and he said, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." I haven't got the slightest idea what a state's attorney is. I never heard of a state's attorney, never seen a state's attorney. I don't know what a state's attorney does. So I said, "Good for you, sign the ticket." So he signed the ticket, and there was a guy who didn't appear to be drunk, so I let him drive the car, and I went about my business. At the end of my shift, I pulled into the parking lot of the Ocean City Police Department, and there stood the chief of police, and he said to me, "Come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words the chief had spoken to me all summer. And I thought, this is a good thing. You know, I'm about to get recognition for a job well done. Long overdue recognition, I might add. So I went up to his office, and when I walked in, much to my surprise, seated right inside the door on the couch was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the chief says, "Give me that book." And I handed him the book. He opened it up to the ticket. He handed the book to the guy on the couch. The guy on the couch took out a pen, wrote across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed," and signed his name. It was at that moment that I decided that I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could be one of those state's attorneys, I definitely wanted to be one of them, because if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic tickets with a stroke of a pen was going to come in mighty handy. So I went to law school. My wife and I got married while I was in law school. And after law school, we went back to Hagerstown, which was that's where I grew up. And I've been practicing law there maybe for, I don't know, 6-8 weeks, and I became aware that our local state's attorney's office was advertising for assistant state's attorney. They had a vacancy. I went right over. Here I am. Answer to your prayers. When would you like me to start? Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I think I heard them say. It's possible that you may have experienced this in your own life. It turns out many of the things that I have thought that were said never have been said. Many things that I thought I saw happen never have happened. I've got a problem with perception. I have a hearing problem. So here's what I thought I heard them say. What? Are you some kind of an idiot? You just got out of law school. You've never been in a courtroom. You've never tried a case. You've never made an opening statement or a closing argument. You've never impaneled a jury. You've never examined or cross-examined a witness. We don't have time to train you. Get out of the office. That's what I thought I heard them say. Now, as a result of good sponsorship, and upon reflection, I believe they said something like, "The position has been filled." But I heard what I heard, and I'm a very sensitive person. And I don't suffer well. And I was hurt. And I was angered. And I left there with a resentment. And in Maryland, just like here in Oregon, I think, we elect our prosecutors. So I went out and found a guy who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. Now, when you get to be state's attorney, they give you a badge. And they also give you a badge case, and that's got a clear plastic thing where you put your driver's license. So when they pull you over and they ask for your license and registration, you just show them your badge case. They don't look at the driver's license. They look at the badge. Oh, the badge officer, deputy state's attorney, Washington County. No, sir. No, sir. I am not upset that you pulled me over. I understand that you're doing your job. Yes, sir. I could have had four or five. Yeah. It's just about 3 or 4 miles, and I'll be home. I think I can stay on my side of the road. Sure. Yeah. Well, I really do appreciate the professional courtesy which you're extending to me, and you have a nice night also, officer. Thank you so much. Now, some of you may be getting a little insight into why I've never been arrested or had an alcohol-related offense, but it gets better. My boss, the state's attorney, was going to be appointed circuit court judge. And if he got appointed circuit court judge, then I was going to get appointed state's attorney. So, I don't know how it is in Oregon, but back in Maryland, every now and then, the local state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong and screws the whole thing up. And that's what happened in this case. And some other guy got appointed circuit court judge. And I was disappointed for my friend. But I was some kind of angry that I didn't get appointed state's attorney. I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. So one night, while having a few adult beverages with some like-minded individuals, it was being discussed about what to do about the state senator. He needed to be taught a lesson. Somebody needed to run against him in the next primary. We needed to get a volunteer. So I ran for the state senate. Now, I didn't know that the state senator was going to run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee, abandon his wife and 3 children, and move to Florida. But he did. And I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate. And that license plate says, State Senator. Now, this is an aid to efficient law enforcement. Because when they come up behind you on the interstate, and they got those overheads going on, and they get up close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads off. And they come up alongside of you, and they turn on that interior dome light, and they toot. Beep, beep. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way, you don't have members of the Maryland State Police tied up alongside of the highway with members of the General Assembly when they can be out arresting real crooks. That guy that got appointed circuit court judge, he didn't like the job, so he quit. So I went over to see the governor. Governor, I'd sure appreciate it if you appoint my friend, the state's attorney, if you'd appoint him circuit court judge. He said, Senator, can't do it. Too much adverse publicity associated with that last judicial appointment up there in Hagerstown. So I will not, cannot appoint your friend. However, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you. It's a 15-year term. There's only two of us in the community at the time. So I became a circuit court judge. Pretty scary, isn't it, Andy? Yeah. Yep. I'm drinking alcoholically the whole time. I mean, I love to drink. I love everything about drinking. I like domestic. I like imported. I like top shelf. I like bottom shelf. I prefer a twist-off cap, but if all you've got a cork in it, we'll work with that. I like the ambiance of drinking. I was a bar drinker. I love the neon lights. I love the way the lights play on the back bar mirror and reflect off of the bottles and the different shapes and the colors of the liquids in those bottles, the tans and the browns and the clears and the yellows and the greens. I loved everything about it. I love the glassware associated with drinking. I love those thin, frosted Tom Collins glasses that start appearing right about this time of the year. I like the stemware of the martini glass. I mean, the gin martini. I mean, where can you find olives like that except in a gin martini? And I'll have to admit to you that at one time in my life, I had a love affair with a gin martini. But I had a really bad gin experience. And even to this day, it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. My drink of choice, well, here... You know, I like the peanut shells. I like the sawdust. I like the shuffleboard. I like the shooting pool. I love those pickled pig's feet. Love those little primrose sausages and those pickled eggs. I love the smell of stale beer and urine. I mean, I loved it all. But my drink of choice was Jack Daniel's Black Label on crushed ice with a twist. That is my very favorite. Very, very favorite. On April the 7th, if you'd have come up to me and you would have stuck a brown paper bag out at me and said, here, Jack, take a pull on this, I would never ask you what's in that bag. Because I know you wouldn't have offered it to me if it wasn't good. Man, it's good stuff. You know, sometimes you have folks over to play cards or something, or maybe to watch a game, maybe Final Four or something like that, and game's over and everybody's going home, and now you're cleaning up around the house, you know, and there's a lot of cans, and, well, this one has a little something in it, and, oh, what was that? You're right, cigarette butt. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I knew there were some cigarette butt drinkers in here, yeah. Yeah, no, you don't have to raise your hands, that's okay. It's all right. I knew you were in here. On April 7th, 1982, a local attorney and myself were going out to get drunk. This was not one of those occasions when I allowed myself to be negligently overserved. The purpose of our going out was to get drunk. I told my wife we were going out to dinner, but he and I knew we were going to get drunk. We were going to get knee-walking, snot-flying drunk, and we did. And we ended up in a local honky-tonk, and had I known that this was going to be my last drink of beverage alcohol, I want you to know that if I had any idea, I would have ordered something different. And if I had the least little inkling that I was going to end up in Seaside, Oregon, talking to a room full of people about my last drink of beverage alcohol, you can rest assured that I would have ordered something else. Because as you're about to hear, there is a considerable amount of embarrassment and shame associated with my last drink of beverage alcohol, which was Tia Maria. How do you think I feel? Yeah. Now, I can tell from the looks on the faces of some of you that you don't have any idea what Tia Maria is. And you don't need to know. Trust me on this one. If you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and you've never had Tia Maria, for God's sake, don't go back out for Tia Maria. It will not be worth it. As a matter of fact, if you're a member or you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, why not just stay here? I mean, what the heck? There's nothing in here that's going to hurt you. And when we go out there, we die. We die. I was just at a thing last week, and I met a guy. He had just got out of prison. He was 7 weeks out of prison. He had been 10 years in AA, right in the center of AA. And, you know, he got busy, things got good, he owned his own business, had people working for him, married, kids, house, the whole thing. So he stopped going to meetings, but stayed sober, no drinking, for another 2 years. And then after 12 years, somebody said, would you like to have a drink? He said, I think I would. And he had a drink that night, and then the drink took a drink, and then the drink took the man. And driving home that night, he ran into somebody, and he killed somebody, and he horribly hurt somebody. And he went to prison for 5 to 25 years, lost his business, lost his house, you know, just lost just about everything for one night. One night. The insanity of the first drink. If you've got the problem, we've got the solution. I didn't know I had the problem, but I learned that I had the problem. That night, April the 7th, was my last drink. My wife's an elementary school teacher. I don't know how it is here in Oregon, but back home in Maryland, I suspect it's the same here in Oregon, that them little elementary school children, they are just germ encrusted. They got germs all over them. And then the germs jump on the school teacher. The school teacher comes home to the spouse. The germs jump off of the school teacher onto the spouse. And I got up the next morning, I had flu. Flu. I'm telling you, them pesky little kids had done it to me one more time. But we go to work. We go to work if we can get there. Because by golly, if I start missing work, somebody might say, I have a problem with alcohol. And I don't have a problem with alcohol. I go to work. And everybody knows the people who have problems with alcohol, they don't go to work. So I'm going to work. Well, the next day was Good Friday, so the courthouse was closed. So I didn't have to go to work that day. I still got the flu, and I developed that upset stomach thing that goes along with flu. And by Saturday, I developed the lower tract distress that frequently accompanies flu. Now, if you got that upset stomach thing going on with that lower tract distress, it's going to hone your decision-making down to a fine edge. Because I didn't know whether to kneel or sit or sit or kneel. And I made the wrong decision on at least one occasion that weekend. And if my wife was here, you could talk to her about that. But Sunday was Easter Sunday. On Monday, they put me in the hospital because I was dehydrated as a result of all that kneeling and sitting that I'd been doing over the weekend. And that night, my abdomen became distended, and they did an emergency laparotomy on me, and they opened me up, and they found that my abdomen was full of gangrene, peritonitis. And then my kidneys quit, and my liver was enlarged and out of whack, and my pancreas was digesting itself, and then my respiratory system quit. And things just weren't looking good for the home team. And I spent 3 weeks in intensive care in the Washington County Hospital. And they got me off the respirator, but the rest of my vital signs and the rest of these problems continued to deteriorate. And so they told my wife they were going to send me down to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. Only they told her that they were going to send me down there to die. Because they didn't think that my condition was going to improve and that she should make plans for my not coming back. Well, I'm glad they didn't tell me that because I'd have found that discouraging. I mean, I'd known people going to the Hagerstown Hospital and they'd died. And I knew people going to Johns Hopkins and they'd lived. So I was thinking this was a good thing. And so I went down to Johns Hopkins and for 2 weeks they did everything but hang me by my toes. Did all kinds of poking and prodding and tests. And my belly button birthday is May the 14th. And on May the 13th, the doctors in charge of my case came in. And before they could really say a word, I told them, I just can't take it anymore. And they said, well, that's why we're here. We don't know what else to do with you, for you, or to you. So we presented your case to the internal medicine department. And we could not get a majority vote on to what's wrong with you. So we're not going to do anything tomorrow. And so I had a day of rest, May the 14th, in Johns Hopkins Hospital, turned 40 years of age. And 2 weeks later, on May the 28th, I was discharged from Johns Hopkins Hospital. My kidney function returned. My liver reduced in size, and the enzymes came back into alignment. My pancreas stopped digesting itself. But when you're in a hospital for 7 weeks like that, they like to have a little discussion with you before they send you home because they want to give you the do's and don'ts. And but if you got an undiagnosed illness, they don't know what to tell you to do. And in my case, they said, Judge, we just suggest you not get it again because the next time it's likely to kill you. And I think it's much better to die. Well, I think it's better to live as a result of an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. I mean, that was my position then, and that's my position today. Just as I was getting ready to leave that doctor's office, one of the doctors said, we want to ask you one other thing, Judge. Do you drink? That's what I thought. Well, I'm a judge. Well, when I was a lawyer, I had to drink with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers, I had to drink with judges. Now that I'm a judge, I got to drink with lawyers, I got to drink with other judges. It's a matter of professional obligation. Of course I drink. How much do you drink? Not much. Well, we'd like you to not drink for a while, because alcohol really does a number on the kidneys, and we don't know what would happen if you took a drink of alcohol, given the condition of your kidneys. There's nothing that destroys liver function like alcohol, and we don't know if you've got any permanent liver damage or not. And, of course, alcohol just destroys the pancreas. And you've got all three of these very vital, very delicate organs involved, and we'd like you to not drink for a while. How long? A year. A year. A year? Well, I haven't had anything to drink since April the 7th, and this is May 28th. I think I could probably do that. They said, no, Judge, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend, and we would like you to not drink for 1 year from June the 1st. Now, I think there are people in this hall this afternoon who have already discerned the injustice that these physicians were trying to foist upon me, because I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. And an argument broke out between these two learned physicians and this knuckleheaded judge as to when I would next drink. And we reached a compromise. And the compromise was that I would not drink until next April the 7th. And then, if I thought any of the pain and suffering and misery I had just endured had anything whatsoever to do with drinking, then I would choose to not drink until June the 1st. And with that, I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital into the most insane period of my life. Not drinking and not changing. Not drinking and not changing. It's very similar to don't drink and go to meetings. I hope that you find people here in Oregon are not telling people don't drink and go to meetings. Because don't drink and go to meetings kills alcoholics. The doctor's opinion is very clear that when you take alcohol away from the alcoholic becomes restless, irritable, and discontented. That was a gross understatement in my case. I was more pissed off in the spring-loaded position, all right? And there's only one of two things that an alcoholic can do when placed in that position of not drinking and not changing, and that is drink again, slow suicide, or drive into a bridge abutment, fast suicide. Because absent a vital spiritual experience, that's what happens to us when we don't drink and go to meetings. Well, we hang on as long as we possibly can, but unless something changes, we either attempt slow suicide or fast suicide. And it always leads to jails, institutions, and the gates of insanity and death. Nowhere in that book does it say anything about taking alcohol away from the alcoholic and everything will be hunky-dory. It doesn't work that way. You take alcohol away from me and the problems start showing up big time, because I don't know how to do sober. Nobody ever taught me how to do sober. And I would go over to the Broad Axe on a Friday afternoon after a hard week's work, and I'd tell John, my God, John, I am sober. Give me a couple of drinks and keep them coming. And I'd slam two or three down, and whew, that's better. I needed that. See, I can't live without the medicine. I don't know how to live without the medicine. And you take the medicine away from me, and I get a little on edge, and I get a little temperamental, and I tend to get upset. And sometimes I'm a little bristly, somewhat prickly. And you know, quite frankly, if you don't mind your own business and just leave me alone, I think you and I get along a lot better. We really would. In fact, if you just do what I told you to do, we are not going to have a problem, you and I. But you keep ignoring me, I'm going to show you who's boss around here. Listen, I don't have a problem, all right? Things are fine with me. Just do it the way I say do it. I am fine, okay? Everything's fine. It's fine, Andy. How'd you like to have your DWI in front of me on Monday, huh? Yeah. Fine. I'm dying of untreated alcoholism, and I don't have a clue. Two friends of mine, Bob and Ken, active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, are watching what's going on with me. I am dying of untreated alcoholism, and they know it. And my dad, my alcoholic father, on July the 3rd, 1968, went past a local church, and there was a message on the board outside that said, "Don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth." And my father went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, July 3rd, 1968, and he never drank again. And he had 15 years of continuous sobriety in this wonderful program when he died. And I carry his 15-year chip along with my chip. And I hope in some small way that I can pay back Alcoholics Anonymous for the gift that Alcoholics Anonymous gave to my dad. He lost that 30-year marriage to my mom. He lost the respect of his children, myself and my sister. When she got married, he was not invited to the wedding. I gave her away because she was afraid that he would come and that he'd be drunk. And he came anyway, and he was drunk. And he lost a business he'd spent 35 years building from scratch. He lost everything of material value, and he lost all the priceless stuff. And then he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous gave him back his integrity, gave him back his value as a man, and allowed him to become the man God always intended for him to be. And Ken and Bob knew that my dad, when he died, had died with 15 years of continuous sobriety, and they came to me. And Bob said, "We have this book in Alcoholics Anonymous, Jack. We call it the Big Book. We thought maybe you'd like to read it to find out about your dad's illness." Clever guy, that Bob. If he had said anything remotely like, "We'd like you to read it so you can find out what's wrong with you," I think we've already established there's nothing wrong with me. And with every passing week, of every passing month, of every passing year that I did not drink, that's proof positive that I'm not alcoholic, because everybody here knows alcoholics have to drink. And if you're not drinking, by definition, you're not alcoholic. Everything's fine with me. Thank you very much. But I was interested in learning about my dad's illness, and so I read that book. And no surprise to me, my dad's in that book. He was a real alcoholic as defined by that book. But there was what was a great surprise to me is that I'm in that book. That book was written before I was born. And yet that book describes experiences in my own life. It describes things that I have felt. I really didn't know what pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization meant, but I knew how it felt. All of our stories are different on the facts, but the feelings, what does pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization feel like? I know what it feels like. And if you know what it feels like, then you know how I felt, and I know how you felt. And that came as a surprise to me. Apparently, it did not come as a surprise to Bob and Ken. I think they were counting on it. Because once I acknowledged that to them, I told them, I said, I've read the book, and I'm willing to concede that there is a possibility, a remote possibility, but a possibility nonetheless, that it is, I may have contracted a very mild case of alcoholism, caught it just in time. And with that, Bob and Ken would come to my judge's chambers every Friday at noon, and they would bring their big books with them and a brown bag lunch. And I had my big book, and we would eat our lunch, pray the Serenity Prayer, read from the book, and they would talk to me about the importance of what we had read, and then I would explain to them as Jack sees it. And as you can imagine, we had some very high-level intellectual discussions there in my chambers. I told Ken and Bob, I thought it was important that they know this. I'm going to tell you too. I think it's important. That while it is true that I spent 5 years in high school, that I went to the community college and got an associate's degree in 2 years. And 2 years after that, I graduated from the University of Maryland, College Park, with a bachelor's degree in 2 years. And 3 years after that, I graduated from the University of Maryland School of Law with a Juris Doctor, with honors, I might add. And Ken said, Jack, we have degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with them. He said that in my office. I thought he could have shown a little more respect. I'd never heard that before. I hear it a lot around AA these days. And of course, the point was, and the point is, I was almost too smart for this program. You know, nobody can be too dumb for Alcoholics Anonymous. But some of us, degrees or no degrees, just way too smart. You see, Ken and Bob, they were willing to risk offending me because they knew that I had been offended before and I'd get over it. And they knew, well, they were willing to risk angering me because they knew I'd been angry before and I'd get over it. But they knew that I was dying of untreated alcoholism. And if something didn't change, the doctor calls it an essential psychic change. Our book calls it a vital spiritual experience. If I didn't have a necessary or vital spiritual experience, not drinking and not changing was going to kill me. In point of fact, I had a gun. I remember sitting outside in the parking lot of the psychiatrist's office. It was June. He had told me that I was coping very well. We should take the summer off. And if I needed to come back in September, I should. And I thought, maybe this is the day I will shoot myself. Now, you don't tell the psychiatrist stuff like that. I mean, when you're paying them $150 an hour, if they're any good, they ought to be able to get stuff like that out of you. And the sheriff in our community had shot himself to death in the basement of the courthouse, and my office was on the top floor of the courthouse, and I thought if I shot myself in my office, it would add symmetry to the building. And you think that's funny? It's a sick crowd. I just offer that as an example of my sick thinking. So, I mean, Ken and Bob, they knew that I didn't know. And not only did they know something that I didn't know, and they knew that I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know, they also knew that if I knew that they knew something that I didn't know, the mere fact that I knew that they knew something that I didn't know would make me angry at them, just knowing that they knew something that I didn't know. But they knew that there was going to come a time, if they were persistent and consistent in delivering the program of recovery to me, that there would come a time when I would actually know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And when I found out that I knew what it was that they knew that I didn't know, that they knew that I didn't know, the fact that I didn't know it and knew that they knew something that I didn't know would no longer make me angry, because in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know when you know that you know, and not a moment before. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. And if you found that to be the least bit confusing, you're still in the right place. It just means you don't know. That's December 22nd, 1989 was a Friday before Christmas. The courthouse was closed. Bob and Ken and I could not meet in my chambers for our Friday luncheon, so we went out to a restaurant and had lunch, and then we went our separate ways. Now, I should say parenthetically here that when I was drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. And after I stopped drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. I think that's pretty clear and conclusive evidence that drinking had nothing to do with any of those six separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with all six of those separations, and we had no idea, none whatsoever. Now, if I don't screw this thing up, come August, my wife and I are going to be married 43 years. If she were here, you'd probably want to give her a chip for that. She's been married all 43 of those years. I've had time off for bad behavior. And this was one of those occasions. I was living in an apartment. I had a girlfriend. I had a backup girlfriend in case the girlfriend found out what I was like. And I had a girlfriend for special occasions. And they objected to my wife, and my wife objected to my girlfriends, and I told Bob and Ken that I was handling this all very well. And if you're looking for a delusional thought, there's a delusional thought. Our book says we're driven by 100 forms of self-delusion, 100 forms of self-seeking, 100 forms of self-pity, 100 forms of fear. That's 400 forms, and that's when I am not drinking. That's when I am physically as sober as I'm ever going to be. 72 hours after my last drink, I will never be any more physically sober than I was then. But the problem with the alcoholic centers in the mind. And I go back to my apartment, and there's a package propped against my door. It's one of those Hickory Farms packages you see at Christmas time. Somebody sent the judge a sausage or a cheese log. I think that's nice. I had a little snack. Take it into my apartment. I got plans for that night. I got plans for the next day. I got plans for Christmas Eve. I got plans for Christmas Day. I got plans for New Year's. I got plans well into next year. I see where this box has been taped shut. I cut the tape with my car key. I'm listening to the answers on my answering machine. I lift the lid of that box. Boom! And I got blown back against the wall. A federal appellate judge was killed in Birmingham, Alabama, about 10 days before that by a package bomb and sent to his house. 5 days before that, a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed by a bomb that had been sent to his office. I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew that I'd opened a bomb. And there was a fire, and I tried to put it out, and I couldn't. I went out in the hallway and I pulled the fire alarm. A neighbor came, said he had a fire extinguisher. I went back to call 911, and when I went to push the buttons on the phone, I became aware that part of my right hand had been blown away. And then after I hung up the phone, it felt like somebody was trying to pull the trousers off my hips, and I looked down at the floor, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I looked at it, and I knew I had been seriously hurt. And my neighbor came, and he had put the fire out, and he asked if there was anything else he could do. And I asked him to get me a towel, and he did, and I opened my trousers, and I did not have the courage to attempt to visualize the wound. I just put the towel where I thought I'd been hurt and put my back against the wall and slid down on the floor. And I was alone. And I was terribly afraid. And I was powerless. I could feel life ebbing away. No idea if I'd ever see my wife or three children again, just die on that floor. The only tool that I had available to me was that serenity prayer that Bob and Ken and I had said every Friday before we began our big book meetings. And I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I couldn't change. And to give me the courage to change what I could and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer and I prayed that prayer and I prayed that prayer and I prayed that prayer. And I cannot tell you whether it was the fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh time through that prayer, but I can tell you that the prayer was answered and God came. And I experienced a sense of peace and well-being, the likes of which I've never experienced before in my life, nor have I experienced it since. And I had no idea if I was going to live or die on that floor, but I knew that if I died on that floor that afternoon, never to see my wife and our three children again, it'd be all right. It'd be okay. And the police, fire, and rescue came bursting through the door of my apartment, and both my eardrums had been blown out, and I was having some trouble communicating with them. And I stopped praying, and as soon as I did, this tremendous wave of fear swept upon me, and I told them if they just go ahead and do whatever they had to do, I was going back to doing what I had to do. And when I went back to praying the serenity prayer, that sense of peace and well-being returned. And they cut all my clothes off of me with the exception of my red and green Christmas socks. They strapped me to a backboard and put me on a gurney and carried me down three flights of steps. And as they were sticking me in the ambulance, our local television station was Johnny on the Spot. And they got pictures of my red and green Christmas socks sticking out the end of that ambulance. And those pictures went around the world on CNN that night. And I went to the hospital to be prepared for surgery. And they couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken. And they allowed him to come back to where I was being prepared for surgery. And Ken held my hand, and he prayed for me. And we prayed together. And they sent me up to surgery, and I don't know how shrapnel knows how to stop when passing through flesh, but I can tell you what they told me. They removed what they called a significant piece of shrapnel that was not resting against, but was in close proximity to my femoral artery. And if my femoral artery had been nicked, you'd have a different sponsor here this afternoon, that's for sure. And they sent me up to a recovery room, and when I came to, my sponsor Bob was at the foot of my bed. And let me say here that it's good to have a sponsor. It's really good to have a sponsor. I mean, sponsors see things differently. They have a different take on things. Bob's at the foot of my bed, and he's smiling. I said, "Bob, I notice that you're smiling. What are you smiling about?" He said, "Well, Jack," he said, "I just think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed." I said, "Harm, Bob?" I said, "Somebody just tried to kill me." "Oh," he said, "I know." He said, "I understand that package you opened contained four pipe bombs." He said, "One pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being, Jack. Two pipe bombs, that's a little redundant. Three pipe bombs, that's around the bend. Four pipe bombs, Jack, I'd say you've made somebody very angry." He said, in point of fact, Jack, man has done his very best to kill you. And the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. He said, Jack, God has spared you for a purpose. I said, really? And what might that purpose be, Bob? He said, I wouldn't be so bold, Jack, as to speculate as to why God spared you. But I know he has work for you to do. And I also know, Jack, that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with either me or with Ken. You're going to have to do that fourth step inventory. Take that fifth step with Ken or with myself. Make that sixth step decision. Pray that seventh step prayer. Make that eighth step list. Begin making those ninth step amends so you can live to good order and equip yourself to be a maximum service to God and to your fellow man while living in 10, 11, and 12. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't come up with that one either. So on Christmas Day, I was discharged from the Washington County Hospital, and I began to take action on the steps of the Program of Recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. Back when Bob and Ken and I were meeting in my chambers and reading the book, what I had was what I call today cake mix recovery. And by that I mean if we'd go over here to your local grocery store and we got a box of Duncan Hines red velvet cake mix, I'm here to tell you on the back of that box, Duncan Hines has a three-step program for the production of a red velvet cake. And if I had a box of that cake mix here this afternoon, I could give it to Andy and he could read step one. Give it to Bill, he could read step two. Give it to Tim, he could read step three. And I'm the kind of guy, having heard the box being read, I'm looking for my cake. Where's my red velvet cake? I read the box. And you see, we're sitting in my chambers in my office every Friday, and we're reading the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm looking for recovery. I haven't done anything. All I've done is read the book. I read the book, and I'm looking for recovery. I read the box, and I'm looking for cake. No action on the box, no cake. No action on the Program of Recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous, no recovery. You know, we are very fortunate people, you and I. I mean, if you think about what's going to take place on Sunday, a lot of people are going to gather up in churches wondering if God exists. And you and I get to watch God work every day. People wonder if the age of miracles was 2,000 years ago. And you and I both know that the age of miracles is right now. And we see it every day. It's hard for me to get my head around the fact that the vast majority of alcoholics die never ever hearing of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those who actually get to Alcoholics Anonymous represent a very small percentage of all of the alcoholics. If you're here, for God's sake, stay here. There's nothing that's going to hurt you here. We go out there, we get hurt, and we get hurt bad. There's nothing in the Program of Recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous that's designed to hurt me. Any pain that I have ever experienced as a result of the Program of Recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous has been a direct result of my resistance to the Program of Recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. My insistence on doing it my way. Ken used to tell me, Jack, if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you've always gotten. If you want to get something you've never had before, Jack, you're going to have to do stuff you've never done before. I get what I get because I do what I do. I can no longer say I don't have a choice, because I know today I do have a choice. You know, it's not old behavior if I keep doing it. But I know where my comfort is. My comfort is in the old behavior. It's familiar behavior. Got lousy results, but I like it. I like hanging on to my old ideas. I mean, I have some terrific old ideas. If you want to talk to me after the meeting, I'll share some of them with you. Now, I know that you've got some old ideas too, and quite frankly, I don't want to hear them. Because your old ideas aren't nearly as good as my old ideas. Because they're my old ideas. And some of us want to hang on to our old ideas, and that's okay if I'm willing to pay the price. But the price can be pretty high sometimes, and pretty long-reaching. The unintended consequences of my behavior. My friend Jerry that I was talking to you about a little earlier, after 12 years, one night, and he took somebody's life, terribly maimed somebody else, lost almost everything in his life of value, and went to prison for 8 years for one night. And the book says the problem for the alcoholic is not drinking. The problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. I don't know what you all do in your minds. All I do in my mind is think. Think. I am really glad I don't have a loudspeaker on my forehead so that you all can know what I've been thinking since I've been up here this afternoon. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. I have a whole warehouse full of evidence that I am not good at thinking, and yet I absolutely insist on thinking. Now, we've got this pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called Is AA for You? And you may be familiar that our General Service Office is always looking for suggestions on how to improve our literature. So I've written to them because I've got some suggestions of how this pamphlet can be improved. And let me share a couple of these with you. Have you ever decided to stop thinking for a week or so and only lasted for a couple of days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who can think without getting into trouble? Have you had problems connected with your thinking during the past year? Has your thinking caused trouble at home? Do you tell yourself that you can stop thinking anytime you want to, even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you missed days of work or school because of your thinking? Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you did not think? Please write the General Service Office and let them know that you think this has promise. Now, the longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, it turns out the less I know. Quite frankly, when Ken and Bob started coming to my office, it's real tough to teach somebody something when they think they know it all. And that was me. I was a know-it-all. Is that a liver transplant for anybody? It's over in here somewhere, I think. I don't know. I mean, I've got ringing in my head, so I'm not sure. Oh, back there. Okay. Well, good luck with that. Yeah. I'm easily distracted. I lose my place. Okay. I'm Jack. I'm an alcoholic. Now, here's something I know with absolute certainty. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today because somebody prayed. Somebody prayed. Maybe a lot of somebody's prayed. I know my wife prayed. I know our three children prayed. My mother, who doesn't think I'm an alcoholic, thinks I'm crazy. She prayed that God would send somebody to help her son Jack, who is crazy. You're here in Alcoholics Anonymous today because somebody prayed. Somebody prayed. Maybe you prayed that prayer of alcoholics, God, please help me. I can't take this anymore. Maybe it was your mom or your dad or your husband or your wife or your sister or your brother, or your employer, or your friend, your children, somebody. A lot of somebody's prayed. Now, you may not believe that, and you may not like that, but that's a problem with the truth. The truth just is. Whether I like it or not, or you like it or not, makes no difference. It's just the truth. Nobody gets to Alcoholics Anonymous on a winning streak, and we all get here because somebody prayed. Now, here's something I know that I think we can agree upon without any dissension or discussion, and that is that the people who are assembled in this room this afternoon have never been assembled together in the history of the world. And we are never, ever going to be assembled together again. And our book says, there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here, right now. There's somebody in this hall this afternoon who has absolutely no intention of being here today. And yet here you are. And you know who you are. And it is not by accident that you're here. There are others of you who are here this afternoon who have been sent here to hear something. Maybe it was something that was said this morning. Maybe it was something that will be said this evening. Maybe it was something that was said this afternoon. I don't know what you were sent here to hear. I just know that you were sent here to hear something. And maybe it's for you. And maybe it's for that sponsee that God is preparing and is going to send your way in the next 2 or 3 weeks. Maybe it's something to take back to your home group, or maybe it's something to take back to your sponsor or one of your sponsees. I don't know. But consider all the twists and turns that your life had to take to put you in this room at this moment. And consider, if you would, all the twists and turns my life had to take to bring me to this place at this point in time. We are not here by accident. We are not here by coincidence. There is one that has all power. That one is God. May we find him now. We have a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous called A Member's Eye View. I think it's the finest piece of literature that we have outside of the big book. That is my opinion. If you have read this pamphlet, then you too have an opinion. If you have not read this pamphlet, then you don't have an opinion. So why don't you get a copy of it and read it? And then you too can have an opinion. At the very end of this pamphlet, it says that on Sunday, in the churches of many of us, there'll be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. In hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, "Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, "Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, The lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead rise. The poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit. Those who burn with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. This afternoon, if they were here and they were to ask me, "Tell us, Jack, what did you find?" I would say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise. And over again in the middle of the longest day and the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April the 7th, 1982. As my good friend Ed was fond of saying, I love each and every one of you, and there is nothing you can do about it. Thanks for letting me share.